That was her reveal wig.
It's terrible.
Yeah.
It's a terrible...
That's why she has it.
It looks like an Amish boy who didn't know what he was doing and tried to cut his own hair. Are we done talking about Trixie Mattel?
Are we ever?
No.
She's perfect.
Maybe it's Maybelline.
She's Beauty and she's Grace. She's Miss United States. Actually, she's All-Stars winner season 4.
And season 7 of RuPaul's Drag Race.
She didn't win that one, though.
I thought she won. Did ever win that one?
No, she only won All-Stars. Violet Chachki won the season she was on for the regular RuPaul.
Either way.
She's a queen in our hearts.
So is Katya.
Katya won Miss Congeniality that season.
Beautiful.
Mm-hmm. And she wore a dress that was like the Red Room from Twin Peaks.
That's funny.
Oh, I loved it.
Ooh.
Bumpy.
All right.
We're back.
Hello.
Together again.
Why are you talking like that?
I wanna.
Don't. You sound like you're talking like your dog.
No, Bougie has a deeper voice.
I know. Okay. Hello.
Hi.
I'm Chrissy.
I'm Shelby.
And this is Pentacles and Tentacles.
The kind of aftermath of quarantine. The yellow kind of. Phase.
We're in the yellow phase. We'll see how long that lasts.
Yeah.
I'm still wearing my mask. Yeah. But I went to the post office today.
Oh.
And they have a rule where there's only one person allowed in like the actual like post office, not where the P.O. boxes are.
Okay.
And this woman was like waiting in line and she's like, I just think this is all a hoax. And me and this other woman were like,
no.
And she's like, she's the only one in this entire county not wearing a fucking mask. And there's a sign on the door that clearly says a mask is required to enter this building.
Mm-hmm.
And she's like, it's a federal place. I don't have to wear a mask. And there's clearly a sign on the door. And I was like, And, like, I live in Farmville, basically. I do.
Yeah, you do.
And I'm just, like, I didn't know how to politely, like, school her with some knowledge. So I was just, like, like, smiling awkwardly at her through my mask, which probably did not look right, because I was probably, like, my eyes, I was, like, just like nodding and like the woman goes into the post office, like the glass box of the post office where you like give your thing for the slip, and the woman in front of me was like, like let out like a deep sigh and was like, I like wearing my mask. And she's like, I mean, it feels nice to be protected.
Yeah.
And I was like, so that's where we're at.
Yeah. You know what I really like about my mask? It hides my double chin.
Yeah.
It's really nice.
Mine hides the fact that I don't like my teeth, so.
Why don't you like your teeth?
Because I have those calcium deposits on my teeth, and I never really noticed them until I went to college, and this kid was like, what's wrong with your teeth?
What the fuck?
And I was like, I don't know.
That's easily fixable, but.
I'm not fixing them. They're part of me now.
Okay.
Also, it's really expensive to fix it.
It is.
And I was just like, unless I want to get veneers. I don't want to get veneers because my teeth are... I have nice teeth other than my calcium deposits on my front teeth. But, like, damn, son!
Yeah.
He was just like, what's wrong with your teeth?
I never noticed them until you pointed them out. And even now, I don't really see it.
They're not that bad. They used to be a lot worse.
Really?
Yeah, I don't know what happened. They calmed down a little bit.
The calcium calmed down. Alliteration.
All right.
That was a weird noise. I really wish I didn't make that.
I wish you didn't either. All right, we're talking about some things today.
Some things in the stuff.
Shelby is going to talk about the Somerton Man after I talk about Richard Speck. Are you done burping?
I don't know where it's at in my whole esophagus, but it's not great.
Well, good thing I'm talking first.
Okay, good.
All right. So, I'm talking about Richard Speck. I got most of this information from Murderpedia, which I... This is the first time I've ever used Murderpedia. And it was the most exciting moment of my life.
Really?
It has everything. This site has everything.
Murder.
That's it. Really, I mean, the names...
And if you just... If you're looking for a place to just get murdered...
go to Murderpedia. But, like, donate to them if you can. But it was, like, super helpful because it has, like, basically everything you need in life to know about murder. You ready for this?
Yeah.
Let me clear my throat.
Oh, it's not a song?
Yeah. No. No. Let me clear my throat.
No, that is not what I was saying.
That's...
it goes like that. I unlocked a weird part of my memory. But continue.
Just wait. There'll be more... parts of your memory unlocked today.
Oh, good.
So, Richard Speck was born in Kirkwood, Illinois, and he was the seventh of eight children.
Ugh.
Big family. Mm. Him and his younger sister, Carolyn, were much younger than his, like, four other sisters and two older brothers. So he was, like, considerably younger than the rest of them. So, needless to say, he was close to his sister, Carolyn.
Okay.
His eldest brother, Robert, died at the age of 23 in a car accident in 1952. Mm. He was very close to his father, who unfortunately died of a heart attack in 1947. He was 54 when he died.
Okay.
And Speck was 6 years old when that happened. So it's like a very, like,
yeah, that's very
traumatic time to lose a father. Not that any time is a traumatic time to lose a father if you're close to them.
Yeah. But, like, when you're suddenly, when it's sudden and you're young, that's very, very hard, especially... child psych-wise.
Yeah, so a couple years later, Speck's mother, who was a religious teetotaler.
Huh?
I had to look up what teetotaler is.
Please tell me.
It's a person who has a complete abstinence from alcoholic beverages, which I find fascinating because Richard Speck was a raging alcoholic. She fell in love with a traveling insurance salesman from Texas.
Okay.
His name was Carl August Rudolph Lindbergh.
That's a lot.
Who was also a very hard criminal, which, spoiler alert, do not buy your insurance from criminals.
I didn't know that had to be said.
Well, apparently it did because he was a traveling salesman of insurance and he was had a 25-year criminal record with, like, forgery and several arrests for, like, drunk driving. So, like, first of all, insurance salesman who was arrested for forgery.
Oh, dear God.
That does not go hand in hand.
No.
He was also a hard drinker, basically the complete opposite of Speck's father, who was a very, like, good man.
Mm-hmm.
Speck stayed with his sister in Monmouth, Illinois?
Probably Monmouth.
Yeah, I'm guessing.
There's no way that's Monmouth.
What if it is?
I mean, it's the Midwest.
So him and his sister, Carolyn, stayed with their other sister, Sarah, in Illinois so they could finish second grade. Well, so he could finish second grade.
Mm-hmm.
And then they moved to Santo, Texas with mom and stepdad.
Okay.
A year after they lived in Santo, they ended up moving to 10 different addresses in the next 12 years in all poor neighborhoods. So they just moved.
Why?
Constantly. I think just because they were really poor and his stepfather was a drunk. And Speck hated his stepfather.
Yeah.
Carl psychologically abused him. He threatened him. He insulted him constantly. Speck had to repeat eighth grade because he refused to speak in class. He had, like, this really lifelong fear of people staring at him.
Really?
Yeah, so he never talked. And then in ninth grade, he started ninth grade but failed every subject, so he just never returned. And then he dropped out around his 16th birthday.
Damn.
Completely. He started drinking at the age of 12.
Wow.
Yeah.
That was loud. I'm sorry, but dang.
Yeah, and by the age of 15, he was getting drunk every day.
Jeez.
He was first arrested. He was first arrested at the age of 13 in 1955 for trespassing and was arrested dozens of times after that over the next 8 years.
Okay.
He held a steady job as a laborer for the 7-Up Bottling Company in Dallas, Texas for almost 3 years. So he held a steady job for a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
In 1961, he met 15-year-old Shirley Annette Malone at a Texas State Fair. And she became pregnant just 3 weeks after dating him. And I have to say it in here now. I hate when people become pregnant so easy, when I know so many people who have been trying to get pregnant for a very long time and cannot. Imagine the fertility that both of them had for that to work. Because 3 weeks after meeting him means she just finished her period when she met him. Mm-hmm. Somehow ovulated.
Yeah.
It happened. Like, that is... The timing was immaculate. I always wonder,
it's like, how do so many teens just get pregnant?
Fertility, man. So, they got married on January 19th, 1962, and they moved in together with Speck, his mom, and Carolyn, and Carolyn's husband.
Okay.
So, they all live together, a giant family.
Wonderful.
But Speck's stepfather and his mother had already separated and Carl moved to California, so he was already out of the picture.
Oh, they divorced.
There's no stepfather anymore in this picture, so he's gone.
Okay.
Skedaddled. It was around this time that Speck stopped using his stepfather's name, which was Lindbergh, and then he went to Richard Franklin Speck as his name. It used to be Richard Franklin Lindbergh.
Okay.
When their daughter was born, Speck was serving a 22-day jail sentence. And his wife had no idea where he was.
What?
He had no idea where he was. What? He was arrested for disturbing the peace after a drunken fight, which is an ongoing theme in Speck's life, is drunken fights and knives.
Okay. Because, like, I don't know why I had this idea of Speck, of him, like, wanting so much attention, because I just remember, like, the tattoo and then Mindhunters and him just wanting to seem like such a badass.
He was a drunk, basically. Okay. He just, I don't think he knew it.
He didn't know
where it was up and what was down. And
right.
After some other crimes, like, he just kept getting, like, arrested and fined and all this stuff. He was apprehended for attacking a woman in a parking lot with a 17-inch carving knife. That's a large knife.
That's very large.
And he was convicted of aggravated assault and given a 16-month sentence that ran concurrently with a parole violation from, like, a previous arrest.
Mm-hmm.
But due to a court error, he was released just 6 months, which was after completing his parole violation sentence.
Oh, dear God.
So, court systems and jail systems. So, after he was released from prison, him and his wife separated, and his mother recommended that he move in with a divorced 29-year-old woman who was an ex-professional wrestler and a bartender at his favorite bar.
Oh.
29 years old. This woman has lived a life.
She sounds wonderful.
And she needs... I don't know. They never said her name, and I didn't look too hard.
I picture her being a Paula for some reason.
Or a Betty.
Oh, she might be a Betty.
She might be a Betty.
A hard woman name.
I just, like, picture, like, Rosie the Riveter. Like, she's ready to, like, punch some bitches.
Yeah.
Or men. Well, men can be bitches.
Both. We don't discriminate.
But the reason was because she needed help babysitting her three children.
Oh.
Don't hire
to just
a criminal to watch your three children. But whatever, he did. He moved in 1966. His wife filed for a divorce, and in the same month, he stabbed a man during a drunken knife fight at his favorite bar, where the ex-pro wrestler lived, worked, didn't live there, worked there. His mom was able to get his sentence reduced.
How?
His, like, the fine was only reduced to disturbing the peace, and he was fined $10.
$10.
And then, because he didn't pay the $10, he was jailed for 3 days.
Wow.
On April 16th, 1966, he became very, very angry when he found out that his ex-wife remarried just 2 days after the divorce was finalized. But can you blame her?
What?
I mean, whoever.
2 days.
I mean, she was ready.
What year did
also,
this happen, though?
66.
Marriage was, like, a virus during that time. People just got married left
Plus,
and
she
right.
had a kid, and her ex-husband was a drunken man who just kept stabbing people.
So, yeah.
So, because of this happened, he moved... He had been living with his sister at this time.
Mm-hmm.
He moved in to the Christie Hotel and began spending a lot of time, basically all of his time at bars.
Okay.
So then, on April 3rd, 1966, Virgil Harris, who is a 65-year-old divorcee, returned home around 1 a.m. to find a burglar inside her house,
mm-hmm.
who was brandishing a knife, and it was not Shia LaBeouf. I told you.
Shia LaBeouf.
Shia surprise.
I tried to find a gif of that, and I couldn't. I was really sad.
So, the man was described as a 6-foot-tall white man who was very, polite and spoke softly with a southern drawl. And I'm sorry, but if I am being confronted by a man
who is
very polite and speaking softly to me, I'm not okay. Like, that is... I mean, I'm never okay in that situation.
That's a serial killer.
But I'm never okay in that situation. But the fact that he was talking...
I'm just in your house. I'm just gonna take some of your silverware.
Like, anyway, he raped her.
Good.
So he wasn't that polite. Mm. At all.
No.
Zero politeness. I don't know why he was... Unless he was just, like, polite to begin with. But he blindfolded her, tied her up, raped her, and then stole $2.50.
Just $2?
Which is $19.92 in today's money.
That's not even a 20?
But it was the money that she got from babysitting the night before. Or that night, because she came home at 1 a.m. So,
not
like...
Not even a 20.
No. Then a week later, Mary Kay Pierce was reported missing, and her body was found in an empty hog house behind the bar that she worked at. She died from a blow to her abdomen that ruptured her liver. Speck was a frequent flyer at that bar mm-hmm. that she worked at, and also he helped build that hog house a month before. The police questioned him and asked him to stay for further questioning, to stay in town and, mm-hmm. like, don't leave. And then they went to go question him at the hotel. Mm-hmm. And then he told the, like, front desk person, because he was, like, leaving with a bunch of suitcases, that he was going to do laundry at the laundromat. Mm-hmm. And the police came back, and they're like, he just left. Like, he just left.
Of course he did.
So they looked up his room, and, like, they went through, and they found items. They found the radio and the costume jewelry that Mrs. Harris mm-hmm. had reported missing from the burglary, and mm-hmm. several other items that belonged to other people from local burglaries that recently happened within the month. So then after this, Speck went to Chicago to live with his sister, and he ended up working on a ship with the U.S. Coast Guard after his brother-in-law helped him get the job. Mm-hmm. Because I guess at this time, you could just easily get a job on a ship. Mm-hmm. I don't really know how that works, but basically, they went to this hiring hall. They're like, he'd be really good, he's good with his hands, like, and they're like, all right, sure. So that eventually ended. His, like, first stint on a ship ended because he got appendicitis and had to be, like, taken back to get his appendix removed emergently, and then he went back on the ship eventually, but then that ended because he got into a drunken knife fight.
No one should be giving Richard knives. Do not let him
We know what happens. So, not a big surprise, the knife fight happened. He gets off this ship. So then him and his brother-in-law keep taking him back to the hiring hall to try to get him on more ships, but he is losing out to jobs because of seniority, because he's new to this. So they mm-hmm. are like, well, we have this other guy who's been on ships like 400 times and you've only been on one.
Yeah.
He overstayed his welcome with his sister and he packed his bags. His brother-in-law continued to take him to the hiring hall to get another job on his ship. And he was staying in like a rent-a-room type place, like a hostel.
Yeah.
He was just staying somewhere where he could mm-hmm. get a room. He didn't have a lot of money. His sister was giving him money to pay for this thing because he overstayed his welcome.
Yeah.
He eventually got another assignment, but it was a little bit away. I think they said like 30 miles and he had to drive there. So when he got there, this spot had already been taken. Mm. So he was pissed. And he didn't have enough money, so he slept in an unfurnished house. So after he was angry about being sent to this non-existent job, he was tired of waiting for a job at the hiring hall. He took the money that his sister gave him because they went down and met him and got him. And he got a room, spent most of the day drinking downtown. And then this woman, Ella Mae Hooper, spent the day drinking with him. Mm-hmm. He threatened her at knife point.
Right.
Again. Mm-hmm. And he took her back to his room, raped her, stole her gun and money. And then he returned to the tavern to drink until around 10:20 p.m. He dressed entirely in black, armed with a pocket knife, a hunting knife, and the stolen revolver. He walked a milk and a half. It's a mile and a half from the room that he was staying in to the to 2319 East 100th Street, which is where the nurses were staying.
Isn't it 2319?
What is that?
That's from Monsters, Inc. Pixar's Dark!
Unless I wrote it down wrong.
We got a 2319! Yeah! It's with the sock on the
door. I know! Side. I don't know. Now I'm, like, wondering if I wrote it down wrong. I don't think I did.
Oh, damn. Now I'm scared.
Anyway, so around 11 p.m. on July 13th, Speck broke into the townhouse in Chicago. had that address. Mm-hmm. I believe it was 2319. Now I'm second guessing myself.
I'm gonna go with it.
This townhouse was being used as a dormitory for several young nursing students. Mm-hmm. Some were Filipino exchange students that were here to, like, learn nursing stuff. Their names were Gloria Davy, Patricia Matusik, Nina Schmail, Pamela Wilkening, Suzanne Ferris, Marianne Jordan, Merlita Garjula, and Valentina Passion. I assume it's Passion. I don't know. It's P-A-S-I-O-N.
Passion?
Sure.
Whatever.
I don't know. So he took the women hostage for hours. He took them one by one out of the room to rape them and eventually either stabbing or strangling them to death. He finally finished with Gloria Davy by raping and strangling her. The only woman escaped was Cora Amiro. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing that right. Her name's Cora. And she was able to hide under a bed while Speck was out of the room with one of his victims. And it's believed that he might have lost count of the amount of victims because 8 versus 1 or 9 versus 1 is a lot. Or he was unaware that there was a 9th person in the room, like hotel, or hotel, the townhouse, because mm-hmm. normally there were 8, but he might have been unaware that there were 9 because they had a friend staying the night. She stayed hidden until around 6 a.m. when she climbed out from under the bed and went to the window and screamed, "They're all dead. All my friends are dead." The police found a partial fingerprint at the murder scene and compared it to another one that the FBI gave them, which belonged to Richard Speck. Later that morning, they found a better fingerprint at the door of the crime scene. 2 days after the murder, Speck was identified by a drifter because him, the drifter, and a man had been out drinking on a fire escape. And then the drifter, like, the next morning, saw the newspaper with the police sketch of Richard Speck. Mm-hmm. He called the police, but around 9:30 p.m., but the police didn't respond to the call for whatever reason, even though it's on record that the call was made.
Sometimes.
I don't really understand how that happened. So Speck attempted suicide, and the front desk lady at the hotel he was at called 911, and they took him to the Cook County Hospital. Mm-hmm. Dr. Leroy Smith, who is a 25-year-old medical resident, recognized him by the Born to Raise Hell tattoo. Mm-hmm. The police were called, and Speck was arrested. The psychiatrist who interviewed Speck remarked that he had experienced the Madonna whore complex, which I had to look it up.
Yeah, I don't know.
Because I have never heard of it before. Mm-hmm. And according to Wikipedia, it's the inability to maintain a sexual arousal within a committed, loving relationship. But then it was identified by Freud, as most things are that regard sex and issues. Mm-hmm. It's said that men see women as either saintly Madonnas or see them as whores. And men who have this complex desire a sexual partner who has been degraded, while they do not desire the respected partner. So they only want women who are more. I would have taken it as more experienced.
So this is going to be really stupid. There, Sex in the City, Charlotte's first husband has this complex. Like, he can only get it up to, like, porn magazines and women he does not see. Women he does not respect and just sees as sex objects.
Yeah.
Where Charlotte is this, like, homemaker, very put together, very clean, beautiful, and he just can't because he respects her too much.
I'm guessing that's what this is, because
I feel like it's the, like, you view sex as so dirty you can't foul someone you respect with it.
Yeah.
So you're going to do it with people who you do not have any respect for.
Yeah, I'm guessing that's kind of what this is. Mm-hmm. And the psychiatrist also noted that Gloria Davy reminded him of his ex-wife. Mm. And probably that's why she was saved for last.
Yeah.
He was apparently very fond of pills, and he was both drunk and high at the time while committing these murders.
Okay.
He said he has no recollection of the murders. At the time of the arrest, he said he had no recollection of the murders. But he was declared sane by the psychiatrist, but he was declared a sociopath, which that makes sense with everything, I guess. The trial began about a year later on April 3rd, 1967. Cora testified at the trial, but she was kept hidden in, like, a witness box because she had a fear of Speck and was there just, she was afraid. But a dramatic moment did happen during court where she was asked if she could identify the killer, and she rose from the seat in the witness box, walked directly in front of Speck, and pointed her finger at him.
Wow. So,
I love a woman with strength.
Yes.
Because I could not imagine how, like, terrifying.
Getting up and getting in front of him and be like, this is the fucker.
This is the dude.
Yeah.
Yeah. After only 49 minutes of deliberation, the jury found Speck guilty and recommended the death penalty on April 15th, 1967. Mm-hmm. On June 5th, he was sentenced to die in the electric chair, but he was granted an immediate stay pending an automatic appeal to the Illinois Supreme Court, and they upheld his conviction. Mm. On June 28th, 1971, the United States Supreme Court upheld Speck's conviction, but reversed his death sentence. Because objectors of capital punishment had been intentionally and systematically excluded from his jury, which is not cool. Yeah. Or, like, you can't do that when you're... Not that it's not cool, like, because I'm... Whatever, my opinion on the death penalty and capital punishment, mm-hmm. but the purpose of a jury is a fair and accurate...
Yeah. You judging. Can't purposely exclude
Yeah,
people.
So they purposely excluded people mm-hmm. that disagreed with capital punishment.
Yeah, that's something you can purposely...
So I feel like you should have 50-50.
Yeah.
I don't know how that works, though. So then the case was sent back to the Illinois Supreme Court for resentencing. On November 21st, 1972, Judge Richard Fitzgerald sentenced Speck to 400 to 1,200 years in prison.
Damn.
Which is 8 consecutive life sentences.
Wow.
Then, because of, like, a new law that was passed, the sentence was reduced to 300 years, which, whatever, like,
still, you gonna die in, if you last long enough to
you
300
would be,
years,
you're not.
Yeah, you're not, but, like, I just spilled water.
Which, somehow, I don't know how this works, but when your sentence is reduced to 300 years, you're eligible for parole.
That's the cap?
I don't know. It says, which somehow made him eligible for parole in 1977.
Mm.
But he was denied parole after only 7 minutes in his first hearing, and then his 6 consecutive parole hearings after that, he just kept getting denied mm-hmm. until 1990. And then I think they just stopped asking for parole.
Yeah.
When he was incarcerated at Stateville Prison, he was given the name Birdman after the film Birdman of Alcatraz. Because he kept a pair of sparrows that flew into his cell.
Yeah,
because
that's in Mindhunter.
Yeah.
And then he kills the bird.
I don't know if that actually happened.
Well, yeah, in Mindhunter, he kills the bird.
I know. But he was described as being a loner, keeping a stamp collection, and listening to music. He basically only asked for, like, new clothes mm-hmm. and, like, a radio.
Mm-hmm.
But he was not a model prisoner, though. Mm-hmm. He was often caught with drugs or distilling moonshine.
Yeah.
And the punishment never stopped him because he would say, how am I going to get in trouble? I'm here for 1,200 years. And he has a point.
Yeah.
No, he had a point. Because he died. Well, on December 5th, 1991. Of a heart attack.
2 years before I was born.
Same.
Damn.
I found this thing on Wikipedia, or Murderpedia. And I could not, for the life of me, do it justice by paraphrasing it mm-hmm. and, like, rewriting it and summarizing it. So I'm going to read it verbatim from what it said, because it blew my mind for whatever reason.
I'm excited.
In May of 1966, a television news reporter, Bill Curtis, received videotapes made at Stateville Prison sometime before the end of 1991, showing them publicly for the first time in front of a shocked and deeply angry Illinois state legislature. The video showed the prisoners passing money and drugs around without fear of being caught, engaging in sexual acts, and in the center of it all was Speck. Ingesting cocaine, parading around in silk panties,
what?
And sporting female-like breasts grown from smuggled hormone treatments and boasting, if they only knew how much fun I was having, they'd turn me loose. From behind the camera, a prisoner asked him why he killed the nurses. Speck shrugged and jokingly said, it just wasn't their night. And the tapes were later broadcast on the A&E Network's investigative reports, were used to argue for the death penalty. John Schmale, the brother of one of the nurses, said it was very painful. It was a very painful experience watching him tell about how he killed my sister in response to the scene in which Speck describes what needs to be done when strangling a victim.
Oh my God.
So there was another section of this that I didn't include, but apparently engaging in these sexual acts was also Speck giving oral sex to other prisoners. So I don't know what happened. I mean, you're gay for the stay.
I just wish he was someone's bitch.
I'm sure he was.
Because he wasn't that big of a dude, right?
He was 6 foot tall.
But wasn't he, like, skinny?
I mean, he was lanky.
Yeah. Someone could take him.
Yeah, he had really bad acne scars from the pictures I saw. But he had boobs.
Damn. Like, I'm not over smuggled in hormone treatments.
Why is my... like, and also how? Just parading around in silk panties.
And how did you get those?
How did you smuggled get in? Well, that was the point, was that...
like, did someone's family member be like, hey, next time you visit, bring me hormone treatments and silk underwear?
I guess.
Or, like, the prison just wasn't...
I don't know.
No. That made me mad.
Yeah, I was really proud how I read that.
I was just like, that made me mad. And more, like, in awe and mad. Just like, how?
That's why I couldn't summarize it.
Yeah.
I had to read it. Yeah. Because...
damn.
And that was Richard Speck.
He had, like, I don't get from his personal, he had, like, these quiet moments, like, I'm gonna collect stamps, and then I'm gonna get drunk and do a knife fight.
I'm pretty sure, I mean, we know that, like, stabbing is a sexual way of killing someone, because mm-hmm. it's penetration. Mm-hmm. So, it just, like, I think he was just a deeply disturbed, hypersexual man.
The thing with the nurses was, so, like, the one that hid under the bed, didn't that also happen with Bundy in the sorority house?
Yeah.
Because that's what I thought. I was like...
no, I think that girl pretended to be dead.
I thought someone hid under a bed, too.
I'm not sure. Mm-hmm. Like, as much as Bundy is popularized, I'm not too familiar with him.
Yeah.
Other than, like, him... other than Zac Efron being Ted Bundy.
The only... like, the thing that makes... at least for me, that made Bundy famous was that he was his own lawyer. I think that was the part that was like...
he was insane.
He was insane. We're not talking about Bundy. We're talking about Richard Speck.
Yeah, so that was Speck. I think it's interesting how him just getting, like, blown down from jobs just mm-hmm. really, like, triggered him.
Yeah.
Like, it just, like, his wife remarrying and then him needing to get a job and never getting a job and then being turned down for job after job just was, like, trigger.
I wonder if this was, like, a toxic masculinity thing. Like,
I don't know.
Have a wife, you can't have a job, you can't do what traditionally a man is supposed to do.
I don't know. It just, like, blows my mind.
Yeah.
A little bit.
Plus, I feel like he had father issues.
Yes.
So,
he had daddy issues.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's it's a masculinity complex.
Yeah.
Oh, Richard. Ugh. All right. It's my turn. I'm going to tell Chrissy and all of you The Somerton Man, popularized by BuzzFeed Unsolved.
Is that where you got your notes?
No, I got my notes... the last bit I got from BuzzFeed, so we'll take those with a grain of salt, but most of them, 99% of these, is from the Smithsonian, which most of my notes come from the Smithsonian.
They have good stuff.
I love the Smithsonian. If I was rich, that would be, like, one of the things I would give to, because I love it so much. That is my happy place. That, like...
it should be.
Yeah, because I was born in Bethesda, which is a naval hospital near D.C., and that I grew up in the Smithsonian.
And remind me to show you a thing about Bethesda.
Bethesda? Okay. But yeah, that is my like childhood home.
Remind
happy place
to show you the Bones episode where she says that
Bethesda. Oh god,
it's really funny. Ooh. Bones is my favorite show, in case anyone wants to know. It's the show I watch when I'm depressed, which is terrible.
Booth is hot.
Well, yeah, so yeah. Is she.
Yeah,
they all are. Let's be real. It's casting.
Oh wait, the one with the curly hair and the beard, the science dude, what was his name? I always found him attractive.
Hodgins.
Yeah. Yeah, he was cute. He did it for me. Anyway. So, Tuesday, November 30th at 7 p.m., Mr. and Mrs. Lyons went on a walk on Somerton Beach. This is all in Australia. The pair saw a man in a suit lying in the sand. His head was against a seawall, legs outstretched, feet were crossed. As the couple got
like this?
Exactly how Chrissy is sitting right now.
Oh my god.
Except laying down in, like, the neck. So, like, if you're completely laying down in your neck, yeah, full double chin warming it. I wish you all could see, but you just did this weird wiggle movement.
I was a worm.
Oh, God.
Would you still love me if I was a worm?
Yes.
Okay.
As the couple got closer, the man lifted his right arm and then let it fall back down.
So he's dead.
The couple thought the man was drunk and trying to smoke a cigarette.
Okay.
Yeah, that, pretty much. Except the right arm. That was my left. This one.
Wait, they lifted his arm?
No, the man lifted his own arm. He was alive at this moment.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, okay.
Continue.
So 7 p.m., November 30th, he is alive.
Okay.
Half an hour later, another couple saw the man in the same position. He was in a nice suit, super shiny shoes. Apparently you could see your face in them. That's how shiny they were. Left arm was splayed out, so out like this.
Yes.
Motionless. Couple thought he was asleep, even though his face was surrounded by mosquitoes.
Ew.
The boyfriend in that couple said something to the effect of, oh, he's so drunk, he's dead to the world.
That's a terrible thing to say.
Now we know it's a terrible thing to say. The next morning, Mr. Lyons went back to the beach, as he would do for a morning swim. Mm-hmm. He saw people gathered around the seawall where he saw the man lying before. The man was still there, cold, a half-smoked cigarette on his collar, like it fell out of his mouth, no marks of violence, and he was dead.
Okay.
Yeah. So.
So this is all within a day.
This is all within a 24-hour period.
Okay.
Okay. The body reached Royal Adelaide Hospital 3 hours later. Dr. John Barclay Bennett examined the body and put the time of death no earlier than 2 a.m. The cause of death noted as heart failure and poisoning was suspected. Inside the man's pockets were a ticket from Adelaide to the beach, a pack of gum, and I think it was Juicy Fruit, which is not a popular gum in Australia at the time. Matches.
Is it a popular gum anywhere?
I think it was popular in the United States at the time.
Because it loses flavor in 2 seconds.
It gets so mushy.
It's either mushy or completely hard.
It's so flavorless, but every time I chew it, it doesn't get hard, like chewier as normal gum does. It like turns into like
that falls apart
pulp and like yeah, melts.
I had a gum like that once.
I had a gum like that once. His name was Gerald. Just so weird.
I'm never speaking again. I know exactly what you're talking about. That's what happens when you like eat expired gum.
It's real bad. I hate it.
Anyway,
Juicy Fruit will never sponsor us. Sorry, Juicy Fruit. There was matches, two combs,
but double mint can,
two combs, and a pack of Army Club cigarettes, which contained 7 cigarettes of a different brand called Kensitas. So the Army Club box had 7 Kensita cigarettes.
Okay.
Yes.
Mix and match.
Yeah. No wallet, no cash, no ID. All the clothes had the tags cut out of.
Okay.
One trouser pocket had been neatly repaired with unusual orange thread.
Okay.
Okay. Now we move on to the autopsy. That was done a day later. His pupils were smaller than normal and unusual. I don't know what that means. Like, okay. Unusual shape, unusually small. Spit had run out of the side of his mouth, like he was unable to swallow it. His spleen was strikingly large and firm and almost 3 times the normal size.
Did he have mono?
Maybe. His liver was distended and congested with blood.
He had mono.
Does mono fill your liver with blood?
It makes your liver and spleen real big.
Oh.
I had mono.
I didn't know that.
You knew I had mono.
I knew you had mono.
It was a terrible time.
You do tell
me. Do not get mono when you're an adult.
That's what you and my dad can talk about, having mono, because he also complains about when he had mono.
I used to, like, compare my life to before and after mono, because my life has never been the same since. Yeah. It was so... I also ignored that I had a fever for 2 months. I lived with a fever of 101 for 2 months, which was probably not healthy.
No, that's not.
My lymph node was, like, this big. I could see it.
Like a full, like...
And I went to see Dr. Patel, and she's like... Oh, you real sick. And she's like, you sound terrible. And I was like, thank you. Because my throat swelled up so bad I couldn't talk. So I was like, hi, I'm Mary Griffin. Wow. I literally couldn't talk. My mouth wouldn't like function as words.
Oh, God. Yeah, no, I've never had mono and I don't want to.
I think Nate gave it to me.
Oh, good.
Because it was right when I started dating Nate.
Nathan.
His name is Nate.
I'm calling him Nathan. It has more impact. Nathan.
Okay, but I blame him.
Yeah. Nathaniel.
Nathaniel.
Okay, more on the autopsy. In the man's stomach was his last meal. Last meal, which was a pasty, which I just think of pumpkin pasties. 2 pumpkin pasties, please. Harry Potter. And more blood. So pastry and blood.
Great. That's a quality meal.
Yep. This suggested poisoning, but there was nothing to show that the food had been poisoned.
Okay.
Okay. Let's see here. Due to the patient's previous behavior, it seemed like slow-acting poison rather than being drunk.
Could have been in the cigarette.
Maybe. Maybe not. Maybe
he's drunk and someone...
Maybe. Repeated tests on the man's blood and organs failed to reveal any poison. No cause of death was found.
Interesting.
Yes.
So they found no poison on him?
Nothing.
Okay.
Nothing in his system at all. Also, the man's calf muscles were also high and
very... It was ketamine. Sorry.
The man's calf muscles were also high and very well developed, although in his late 40s. Also, his toes were oddly wedge-shaped.
What year was this?
But I never wrote the year down. I think it was the 60s.
I'm just judging, because even though in his late 40s he had nice calf muscles, like...
I mean...
I know a lot of men in their 40s who have nice calves.
Yeah, okay. But I literally got this off
the... His name is Greg Bailey.
Greg Bailey is also...
An orthopedic surgeon.
Yes. They're all jacked.
I know. Well, no, they're not.
I feel like...
I had to help one of them put 45 plates on his machine once, and then he put them on the floor and made me pick them up later.
Bruh.
It was not Greg Bailey. He would never do that.
Greg Bailey would never do that to you.
He doesn't even know my name.
What if he did?
He doesn't. I accidentally almost hit him with my car once.
What?
Because he runs behind our office after work, and he like jumped out from behind a bush, but like,
yeah.
You know the bush, like where our office is at? Mm-hmm. Like there's like the hedges.
Yeah.
He was like turning a corner,
mm-hmm.
and I was driving, and I was like, I Hank Hilled.
No. Oh. Also, his toes were oddly wedge shaped.
Webbed?
Wedged. Wedge.
Ew.
Yeah. This is a quote from the coroner. I have not seen the tendency of calf muscle so pronounced as in this case. His feet were rather striking, suggesting, this is my own assumption, that he had been in the habit of wearing high-heeled and pointed shoes.
Or
ballet point shoes.
Oh, okay.
And if you have ever seen a ballerina's feet...
They're ugly.
They're awful. They go through hell and back.
Oh.
Which would make a lot of sense.
He had ugly feet.
Mm-hmm. And this really solidified my theory of what has happened, but we'll get there at the end. So, Coroner Thomas Cleland, I can read, contacted Sir Cedric Stanton Hicks about poison. Sir Hicks is a...
toxicologist.
He was like a professor and very well-versed in poisons. Sir Hicks said that it would have been a very rare poison that would decompose very early after death. The only poisons that Hicks knew of could do this were so deadly that Hicks would not say their names in court. I don't get that. He wrote them down and handed the piece of paper to Cleland. Two possible candidates were on the paper. Digitalis and strophanthin.
Okay.
Yeah. Hicks thought it was the strophanthin. Strophanthin is a rare glycoside derived from the seeds of some African plants and were used by a small, very not well-known Somali tribe for poisoning arrows.
Okay, I've heard of that.
Mm-hmm.
I've heard of the poison arrows before.
Yes. A full set of fingerprints was taken, no matches in Australia or the entire English-speaking world. People were brought into the morgue to hopefully identify the man. No one could. They put his face in papers and reached out to people who had missing family members or mm-hmm. people they knew. No one could identify him.
Hmm.
No one could give him a name. So, January 11th. Investigators then began to search any abandoned personal possessions in the area.
Mm-hmm.
They checked every hotel, dry cleaner, lost property office, train station for miles. And on the 12th of January, detectives found at the main railway station in Adelaide a brown suitcase that had been deposited in the cloakroom on November 30th. So the day when he was first seen.
Okay.
Inside was the same orange thread used to fix his pants.
Okay.
The case had no stickers or markings, and the label had been torn off from one side. Again, all the tags were missing from the clothes, except for three items. These three had Keen, K-E-A-N, or T, K-E-A-N-E, on them. Police were unable to trace anyone by that name. Police concluded that somebody purposely left those names, knowing that the man's name was not Keen with an E or Keen without an E.
So it was a setup.
Yes.
Okay.
Inside the case was a stencil kit used by the third officer on merchant ships responsible for the stenciling of cargo, a table knife with the haft cut down, and a coat stitched using a feather stitch unknown in Australia. How do you... I don't know. That baffled me. We're moving on. A tailor
said... Don't sit with that one.
No. A tailor said the stitch work was American, suggesting the coat and wearer had traveled during the war years, World War II. Shipping and immigration records showed nothing. After 4 months, the body was examined again, and a secret pocket, which was not secret, they just missed it. It was literally a pocket meant to hold a pocket watch, and they just didn't look at it.
Okay.
Idiots. Was found in the man's pants, and inside was a tightly rolled piece of paper, which had the words Tamam Shud typed on it. The words are Persian, and from a book of poetry called the Rubaiyat, or Rubaiyat, I think it's Rubaiyat, from Omar, the Rubaiyat of Omar Khayyam. This had become very popular in Australia during the war years and was translated by Edward Fitzgerald, written in the 12th century. Tamam Shud translates to "It is ended."
Oh.
Ominous. South Australian police never turned their missing person case into a full-blown murder investigation. Body began to decomp, so they took a cast of the head and upper torso, had the corpse embalmed, and then was buried in dry earth and covered in concrete just in case the body needed to be exhumed again so they could keep it as well preserved as possible. As late as 1978, flowers could be found at odd intervals on the grave, but no one could ascertain who had left them there or why.
Ew.
Yeah, so someone's leaving flowers. Now we move to July. A Glenegg man, so Glenegg's close to Adelaide, comes to the police station with a copy of the Rubaiyat. Early in the previous December, just after the body was found, he had gone for a drive in his brother-in-law's car and found a copy of the book laying in the back seat. So his window was open, and he found a copy of the book in his back seat. So him and his brother-in-law, thought that it was each other's book, and they never talked about it. They just assumed that, oh, it's my brother's book. Oh, no, it's his book. And it had been in the glove compartment ever since. Then they read an article about the man and Tamam Shud being from that book, and they took a closer look at the book. The final page of their copy had been ripped out, and the final words Tamam Shud were missing.
Ooh, creepy.
Page flip. So, they took that copy of the book. On the book was a telephone number written in pencil. Using a magnifying glass, there was a faint impression of some other letters written in capitals underneath. The phone number was unlisted, but it belonged to a young nurse who lived near Somerton. It says in the Smithsonian article that she had never been publicly identified, but then in BuzzFeed, she's referred to as Jo Thompson. But in Smithsonian, she's only known as Jetson, or Jestyn, J-E-S-T-Y-N.
Okay.
So, I'm going to call her Jo. The nurse admitted she gave a copy of the Rubaiyat to a man she knew during the war. His name was Alfred Boxall.
Okay.
So now the police think, oh, this dead man is Alfred Boxall.
Mm-hmm.
Boxall's home was traced to New South Wales. He turned out to still be alive, and he still had his copy of the Rubaiyat intact.
Ew.
Yeah. South Australian police did not question Joe a lot. The few questions they asked revealed a little bit of information. She said that sometime the previous year, her neighbors told her an unknown man had asked for her. And when Joe was shown the cast of the man's face, she was apparently completely taken aback to the point of giving the appearance she was about to faint. She seemed to recognize the man, but firmly denied it.
Shady.
Yes. Going back to the book, under UV light, five lines of jumbled letters could be seen, the second of which had been crossed out. The first three were separated by the last two by a pair of straight lines with an X written over them. This suggested some sort of code. So the police was sent this to the Naval Intelligence to cipher the code. Apparently they are the master code breakers, and they determined it was unbreakable.
Okay.
Yes. Police never cracked the code, and then Joe died a few years later.
That sucks.
She did have a child. She had a son, and he had some very similarity, some strong similarities to the Somerton man. He had odd ears, missing incisors, his left canine was next to his two front teeth, and he also became a dancer and had very strong calves.
Baby daddy.
And at the time, Joe was married.
Oh.
So my theory is it was an affair, and that man did not know that this was not his child, probably. And she did not want to admit it.
That makes sense.
Yes. So the drugs that they thought could have been in the Somerton Man system, but decomped, could be found in pharmacies, never over the counter, can be used as muscle relaxants to treat heart disease.
Well, that would explain the death.
So that would explain where to get them. Here is my theory, and a lot of people think that this man was a spy.
Oh.
Like a Cold War spy.
Okay.
My personal impression is if he was a spy, he had been in Russia at some point. Russia is known for ballet. Mm-hmm. If he had been a ballerina or training as a ballerina at some point and was spying in Russia for the United States, because recently his DNA was traced to Native American tribes along the east coast of the United States and relatives of Thomas Jefferson. Yes.
Interesting.
So he's an American, possibly spying for the U.S. in Russia. Maybe
somehow ended up
in Australia. Maybe he got caught and got scared and ran.
Had an affair
with this woman. Told her, "You can never. If I die, you cannot tell anyone you knew me." Had his kid.
I never knew anything about that.
Mm-hmm. And I think he possibly poisoned himself.
Like cyanide, almost.
Yes, if you get caught, take this pill, type of thing. Yeah.
When they put it on there.
And I think that's why he was laying on the beach, just last moments.
Chilling on the beach.
And dropped off his suitcase somewhere else. I think he killed himself because of something happening, and I am so sure that man was a spy.
That makes sense.
Yes.
I have a really hard time believing that spies are real, but I know they're real.
Like, all those spy stories have to be based off something.
Yeah.
And the minute they talked about his, like, calves and his feet, and they're like, oh, he could be a ballet dancer, I was like, Russian spy, Russian ballet, I got this. I could be so wrong, but, ooh, it just feels right. It feels so right.
Interesting. I never knew any. I'm definitely on board with your theory, though. Although I feel like it's really hard to be like a ballerina, especially a point dancer.
It's very hard.
So he must have been like,
or so if he was a ballerina in the United States, let's say when he was younger, and the U.S. was like, "Hey,
you can dance.
You're a ballerina, and a lot of ballerinas go to Russia. You want to work for us?"
Maybe, yeah. You're unassuming. You can. He could speak Russian.
Yeah. I mean, maybe he had a Russian teacher. Like, Russian ballet instructors come to the U.S. That happens. So the son did get married and had a daughter. Mm-hmm. So it is possible that this woman is the Somerton Man's granddaughter. And I think they were testing their DNA. I could not find. That was from the BuzzFeed article that it said conclusively this is her grandfather. Mm-hmm. But they did test his DNA, and it was found to be from Native American tribes along the East Coast and Thomas Jefferson.
That's bonkers.
I know.
Wow.
Crazy stuff.
All right.
Fascinating.
That was a big episode.
Yeah. I'm pooped.
Me too. We ate a lot of food.
Oh, KFC. All righty. So, be safe. Have fun. Make some new friends, still socially distance, 6 feet apart. I hope you learned something new, and please come back here.
Bye! Bye.